This is The Think Tank with Dr. Mike O'Neill, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
All right. Topic of the day is women in the workforce and the extent to which there are problems, the extent to which things may or may not have changed. I have four women guests, two of them in the first couple of segments, the first of which is Tammy Caputi. She's a small business owner and is running, I think, a second try against two candidates in Legislative District 23. Incumbent is Kavanaugh. No, not true. Correct me.
I'm considering a run for Scottsdale City Council, but not announced yet, and definitely not running for the ledge again.
Well, then I got that. I think I got that out of Ballotpedia or somewhere. But
interesting.
I'll have to find it for you, but it's somewhere on the web that said that.
Ballotpedia actually announced that I had won the election in 2016, too.
Take it.
Right? I think I'm already in.
You know, there was a famous case in the early days of the internet where Pierre Salinger, the press secretary to President Kennedy, announced that something was true. How do you know that's true? That doesn't make any sense. And he said, well, I read it on the internet.
Right. Well, and if I say it loud enough and long enough, maybe it'll be so.
It'll become true. That's an old political trip. Okay. Well, I stand corrected. Lorraine Rogers, I'm going to go to you first. You are someone who has been both in the public and the private sector as a CIO, Chief Information Officer for Phoenix at Xerox, worked at Citibank as a senior vice president. And I'm pretty sure that of the women at the table, you've been around the longest. So I want to ask you the obvious question. Not only what challenges did you face as a woman in the workforce, but in the course of your answer, if you could tell us the extent to which things either have or have not changed.
I'd be happy to. Well, listen, when I started my first job in computer programming, it was a while ago, 1965.
Wow. My mother started as a computer programmer the same year. There were no computer programmers at the time. She
correct.
Had a degree in mathematics, and they hired her as a programmer.
Well, I had no degree. I had a high school diploma, which I received at 16, threw away my college scholarship for personal reasons, and decided I was going to be a clerk because that sounded like fun and go out and have a good time. Uh-huh. And unfortunately, I worked a little bit too much, so the clerks I worked with were very jealous and upset. And I kept getting raises and moved out into the hall, and finally the controller said to me, listen, we're going to have to fire you, but you seem pretty bright, so we're going to let you take a programming aptitude test. And I says, what the heck is that? And he said, oh, it's an up-and-coming field. So back then it was called computer programming. I wouldn't say I was a woman mm-hmm. in tech or even a woman in business. Mm-hmm. Back there, trying to find a job was really hard. First of all, it was help wanted male, help wanted female.
I was going to point that
definitely.
Out and wondered if you recalled that.
Oh,
yes.
I recall it very well. Yeah. So I walked the streets of New York, where I grew up, and I went to, a big phone company there. And I was told women will never—
There was only one phone company there.
That's right. Ma Bell before all the breakups, right? Yeah. And I was told, yeah, you can work here. You can be an operator plugging and unplugging mm-hmm. things. I said, I want to be a programmer. Nope, only men with college degrees are programmer. Women, now, if you ever do go back to school, honey— mm-hmm. then you can maybe be a computer operator and hang tapes. Mm-hmm. And I said, no, I want to be a programmer. And she said, well, you're going to have a tough time. First of all, are you a virgin? I said, what? And it kind of went downhill from there.
Wow.
And I was in
shock. Starting pretty low to go down from there.
Yeah. And so she was laughing at me. And I realized I was undaunted, actually. So I had to pay an agency. And the only reason I got my first job, I was vetted for my behaviors by a peer there. And he said, to his boss, I met her. She could ask and answer questions, and she didn't flirt with anyone in class. So basically, I was hired. I left a year later.
Was this as a programmer?
Yes, I was a programmer for a year. He mm-hmm. was a programmer for a year. And I left a year later. 2 weeks after, I found out he was earning 48% more than I did. I made $5,200 a year. He made $8,700 a year. So it was quite interesting. I went to an event at a hotel where they had companies. This one had a government contract. He grabbed me. He said, "What do you want?" And I said, $8,700, just like Don. And he said, "You're hired." And I said, "Darn, I didn't know my value." Yeah. You know, I could have actually asked for a lot more. But in terms of how that changed over the years, just how do you find a job? How do you get hired? Oh, my gosh. But it brings me to one key point that I have found, and that you can have a law. In fact, the year I started was right after the Civil Rights Act had been passed and Title VII came in. And that meant, you know, it was equal opportunity, basically. You know, we wouldn't have any problem, except there was no teeth to it. Mm-hmm. So then a couple of years later,
Title VII dealt with gender discrimination.
Right. So mm-hmm. in 72, the EEOC came along mm-hmm. and said, well, if somebody doesn't do this, you can sue them. So basically, I worked unprotected. Mm-hmm. But it went for far longer than that, because as we all know, first there's a law, then you have to have people at the table to make the law be nice. Thank you, anyone who's in politics right now mm-hmm. and who thinks clearly. It's very important. And so it took a while before this kind of permeated. But it's not – I don't think – it's better today. You can find a job anywhere, but do you find the right job? The second is the pay inequity that I touched on. Women still today leave their jobs in technology. 34% more women. Men leave at – I'm sorry. I didn't say that. Women leave 34% of the time if they're unhappy. Men leave 24% of the time. So women are leaving more. And technology is so critical. You know, if you look at it strategically, which when you're in technology over those years, what I learned was to just, you know, I didn't believe that there were walls. I believed everything is possible. Some things just take longer. So if I ran into a wall, I tried to figure it out and scramble to get somewhere first. It was very easy to weave through a system that, as you pointed out, your mother and I knew there were hardly any men. And they were basically engineers, and people like your mom with a math degree had it. So pay inequities have not changed that much. And what's really sad is corporations and government has to understand that tech is at the heart of everything. Technology enables a system that is interconnected. It's at the core. And it's like a ripple effect. It's past – you hit one domino and it falls down. We're way more complex than that. We have a whole internetworked world. We work at intersections. We group and we regroup. And if you don't understand that technology and understanding how to use it strategically really can help you do that, you don't know your value and you don't understand your worth. So I think women in business, regardless of their role, marketing and others, are really embracing it as a way to go. But you need to be positioned, because when that law comes in, you could be doing things before then. It's really important then to understand that you're at the table, you mentor others, you realize that as a leader you can move forward, and super techs have a key role because you know you can't do it without them. So it really pulls everybody up and really levels the playing field.
Last question for
yes.
you, and then we have to go to break.
Right.
You've got some historical perspective. How much have things changed and not changed?
Well, I happen to have two children and a grandchild who's in technology. Mm-hmm. So in terms of my daughter, I remember one day she called me at work. She said, "Mom, creepy guy was in here again today, and I wasn't invited to this meeting," and whatever. She says, "You haven't done much, Mom." So I don't think, and that wasn't that many years ago, I don't think we're where we need to be. There have been advances. Look at us. We're four women. We're at the table. Maybe in the beginning we created our own tables, but that doesn't matter because we knew we had to be where others were. In terms of how it's changed from sexism, there was Me Too long before there was Me Too. That's all I can say. And sexual hostilities, harassment, microaggressions, you know, these teeny little things that mm-hmm. some would say, "Oh, why are you bothering about that?" Well, why not? You know, it all kind of builds. And so still, there's a lot of separation of men and women.
We'll talk to Tammy Caputi when we return in just a moment in the Think Tank.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we are talking to four women about women in the workforce. Tammy Caputi has run a small business as an owner, and she has been involved in basically many of the same issues, but I'd venture a generation or so later. I wonder if you'd tell us your story.
Maybe about a generation. Yeah. I'm in my 50s as well, so not that young. Yeah. So I sort of span the breach there. I actually grew up in a family business with two brothers. I worked in the family business for a bit, electrical distribution. So I was pretty much the only woman in the business at the time.
So you're dealing with contractors?
Only with electrical contractors.
Okay, another man's world.
Correct.
Okay.
So, I mean, going back to the Me Too, sexual harassment was just part of the day. I never really even thought of it like that. I don't even think we had a word for sexual harassment back when I first started working in the 80s, mm-hmm. 90s. It was just part of the day. You would go make a sales call on a customer and you would have to walk past, you know, pictures of women doing strange things to tools and just sort of ignore it and go about your day. Mm-hmm. So I worked in the family business for a while. After a few years, my father took me aside and said, Tammy, the business is for the boys. Hmm. Interesting. I know. And I thank my dad actually for being so clear in the sexism. There was no wondering whether I just wasn't good enough. Uh-huh. It was very clear, you're not going to do this because you're a woman.
Wow.
So that made it easy. I moved away from where I had grown up, moved out to Arizona and opened my own company. And then, of course, had all the same and more challenges.
It's been same type of business or different?
Exactly the same type of business. So I took my experience growing up and moved it into trying to make a go at it in Arizona. Arizona has a program. It's Small Business Enterprise, Disadvantaged Enterprise, mm-hmm. which I certified with the City of Phoenix.
I was going to ask about that. I think it was LinkedIn page said something about a DBE, Disadvantaged Business. Your
right.
disadvantage is?
My disadvantage is that I'm a woman
okay.
in construction, which
okay.
is sort of interesting. We used to have a separate program, women-owned business.
And now it's?
But
it's,
now it's all fixed. We don't need that anymore.
I see.
So, yes, the disadvantage is being a woman. And that program has...
Because I'm not, generally speaking, I'm not used to thinking of Wellesley graduates as disadvantaged.
Right? So. I know. And I hear that a lot, too. It's interesting. So it's been a double-edged sword, the program. It's gotten me to the table on, I'm allowed to give a bid for certain projects. And, of course, I still have to be the competitive bid.
I'm going to probe that. Question about that program. Are those actual DBE set-asides or are they merely does it merely –
It's a wish list. The City of Phoenix would like a certain percentage of jobs that are publicly funded to go to disadvantaged businesses, okay. so they do their best.
So and a given job, it's never a preordained outcome.
No.
It's just you're getting a boost to
– I get to be at the table.
You get to be at the finalist
exactly.
table or
which
like
is great.
That.
It's great mm-hmm. to be at the table. The problem is men are so used to doing business with each other, and they don't tend to go outside of that unless they're sort of forced
primes the pump.
And so that's why it's a double-edged sword. A lot of times I will get the job. We'll have a great experience. I'll do a wonderful job. I'll go to the customer after asking for another project, and what I get is, well, there wasn't a requirement on this job, which I find fascinating. And so in other words, if you didn't have a gun held to your head, you're not going to do business with a woman. Mm-hmm. I guess not. And then the other problem is I'll often get you only got the job because you're cute or because mm-hmm. you're a woman. You know, you sort of can't win. It's an interesting place to be in.
I remember I was on the other side of that once. Well, we're not on the other side. As a vendor with the City of Phoenix, and I was approached by a minority firm on a job where we were the incumbent vendor. It was a job at the airport, and basically they said we're a minority firm, so you can just do all the work under us, and we'll take a cut. And I mean, I think that's a lot of people's image of that, and they were basically trying to sell that, and I said no, thank you, I don't want anything to do with that, and we got the job anyway, but.
It's
right.
frustrating.
That's the worst. That's the worst element of that.
Exactly.
Is when you weren't even going to really give the job to somebody else. It was just they said, well, we'll just be a front. Well, I looked into it. It was not a set aside. A set aside meaning, just in case you're not in contract, a set aside means this job will go to a DBE.
I don't think things are going to really change until we get women at these decision-making mm-hmm. positions. I say this all the time to my customers. I mean, until we get women in the decision-making positions, you're still going to always have these situations where they sort of have to do business with the woman because they've been mandated to, right? Mm-hmm. We need women at the decision-making tables in order to make the world different. Mm-hmm. There's this – the problem with being a token woman is that it's very, very hard to be yourself. You sort of have to go with the male model of success that we've been shown. And when you're the only woman in a place where there's all men, you end up having to sort of outman the men. You've mm-hmm. got this model of success, it's male, and you have to follow it. If you try to do your own thing, they're just going to say, no, we're not going to put up with this. We'll do business with the other guy. When you get a critical mass of women in any organization, and that's generally been estimated at about 30%, you can start to change the world. Women are more comfortable. They can start to be more themselves. They can bring in their own strengths. We can start changing the rules of engagement to actually suit us. We don't have to just go with the way that men have written the world. We can make it work for ourselves. That's the world I'd like to leave for my daughters.
You know, I can draw an analogy from personal experience. Many years ago, I worked as a police officer in Baltimore. And I was in a different, the only handful of blacks in the police department at the time, no women, or maybe one policewoman or something like that. But it's an analogy. And I noticed that the officers who were in predominantly black outfits got to behave a little bit differently. The ones that were the token, the one or two, had to be sort of super cop.
It's a very uncomfortable position to be in. I'm just going to close by saying that, you know, women are half the population. We need women leaders who are going to say the business is for the boys and the girls and then make it happen.
We'll be back in a moment in the think tank.
Let's call them on with a song.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we are continuing to discuss women in the workplace. A couple of different guests this half hour. Kathy Sachs is a former business owner, a publisher. And Representative Athena Salmon represents State Representative City of Tempe across the Baseline Road from my own home. She is experienced in nonprofit, if you consider the state of Arizona nonprofit, and was famously one of nine women to come forward with sexual harassment allegations against former House member Don Shooter, and who was ultimately expelled from the House. And I wanted to ask you about that. And the question is, the Shooter case, was that an extreme singular example, or is it a more generalized problem of sexual harassment in the Arizona House?
To believe that specifically legislatures are immune to that is definitely not the case. I think we saw in Arizona, in the example of Don Shooter, harassing.
He was about as extreme, I think, an example as you're going to come up with.
I think in California there were women that were actually assaulted, sexually assaulted. So it really underscores that we live in a country where harassment, whether it's sexual harassment, physical harassment, verbal harassment of women, is still widely acceptable and widely unaddressed. And, you know, it's frustrating, but when we're in the chamber, when we're in a place where we're actually making laws that impacts everyone, I believe elected officials should be held to a higher standard, whether it's based on sexist behavior or even racist, homophobic behavior. These things should just be non-negotiable. In a place like the state legislature.
But you answer at a theoretical level. I'm asking a very specific question. Currently, post-Don Shooter, is there a problem with this right now in the state House of Representatives?
You know, it's extremely disappointing. So after Don Shooter was expelled, we changed the House rules to create a code of conduct that all the lawmakers would be beholden to. Because unlike other workplaces, when you have a body that's elected officials, there is no HR that can fire us. It either is contingent upon the members to expel
Which is
another
considered
person,
a very extreme act which and rarely extreme, engaged in.
And it's rarely engaged, or for the voters to take the elected official out. So, you know, in the midst of the sexual harassment conduct that was occurring long before I even was elected. I was elected in 2016. The Republican speaker said, okay, we are going to create a code of conduct for all the members to follow. Well, that was in 2018. In the last legislative session, we are about to end 2019. And despite the minority party's pleas to come up and create this code of conduct, you know, now Speaker Bowers has yet to succeed in doing that, has yet to create it and implement it. And so I think that is one of the tragic things that we see, that even in being the first state legislature to expel a member as a part of the wave of the Me Too movement, we still have yet to create that code of conduct that will hold us accountable and hold us to a higher standard. And the reason that that's a problem is not only because of sexual harassment, but we've seen, you know, David Stringer last year make really inflammatory, offensive and irresponsible statements about the largely immigrant population that exists in Arizona. We see another senator who is still there making inflammatory and just outright racist statements about our community. So it wouldn't be something that would just protect against sexual harassment. I would like to see it be something that ensures that the state legislature is a welcome place to all, to everyone.
Would that kind of a code, if, as you would envision it, would that extend? Where it gets touchy is where it extends to speech. Would you include speech in I mean, you understand, you get into a touchy area in that.
You know, but you can't carry a hostile working environment based on someone's race, religion, gender, sexual orientation, et cetera. And the courts have found that while, you know, constitutionally speaking, the First Amendment protects all of our speech, lawmakers have the right to restrict our own speech.
As a workplace issue.
And as a governing body that is within our rights to create restrictions so that we can continue to achieve and fulfill the task at hand, which is to pass policies, develop laws that are going to be in the best interests of our constituents.
Okay. Kathy Sachs, you've been a publisher. I wonder if you might comment on what you've heard thus far.
Hi, I'm glad to be here. We're seeing some trends. I think from when you consider Lorraine's position, Tammy's and Athena's, and I'll share the same. I think at the higher level, what we're looking at today is how do we get more women into decision-making arenas? And that's a challenge when you have a lot of that decision-making being protected, and it is a boys' club, and what the consequence of that continual sort of closing of the doors rather than opening. I mean, it's opening, and we can discuss how it's opening, but it's still essentially closed. When you hear Tammy talking about not getting a deal, even though she her company did a great job, not getting another deal because the guys want to keep it within the guys' network. So the consequence of that is you get lower quality decision making. You get limited viewpoints. You get a lot of where we've landed today. So in my view, as a woman in the workforce today, as a business owner, as an entrepreneur, and as a mother to two daughters, I continue to be. It's interesting. I'm in this. I'm excited about, and I'm optimistic about the future. And I'm also still really pissed off.
Tell me how it's impacted you or your business.
Let me tell you a little story. I think it's interesting going back. So I went from childhood to adolescence through the 80s and early 90s. And I was raised by immigrants, parents that escaped communism, communist Hungary. And they came here with no money, no language, and eighth grade educations. And so I grew up watching my mother work in factories. And so she was a working mother. And my father was an entrepreneur. He had a business. He was a mason contractor. And so, and I'm the only child. It's funny in your 40s to say you're a child.
We're an only child or whatever. We're that for our whole life. You can be firstborn or lastborn.
Right, exactly.
And the psychologist will tell us we'll take that one to our graves and everything it means.
So it's really such a dichotomy because being the only child, I was acutely aware of the fact that my father really wanted a son. And there were a number of times where I heard him say that, right? And so, but at the same, but it was okay because at the same time, he loved me greatly, and he also taught me to be really tough. I had no choice but to be tough. He was a tough, tough, scary dude. He still is, but I'm not scared of him anymore. And so I say this because he also instilled in me a work ethic and an ability to show up and share my voice and what that did for me. And I also learned to view entrepreneurship as something not really risky, because that's just the way it's done. So I think what's really interesting is we live in a world where women are valued for their softness, for their femininity, for their kindness, for their generosity, for all the things that we think, you know, women are so great at. But then on the other side, we're expected, if we want to play, we're expected to be a badass, right? And what mm-hmm. that means is you're someone who can hang with the guys. And so what I learned as I moved through my career was I was one of those women who was typically the only one at the table. I come from tech. I come from media. I come from the venture-backed world. I've become an angel investor. I write checks to founders, and I'm part of a movement now of creating more female check writers. But to me, it was always a privilege to be the only female at the table. And again, to my earlier point, now I look around and I say, I'm just mad. That's just not the way it should be.
Being the only female at the table, did you feel constrained or felt
100%.
Like you had to behave differently?
100%. Whether you're on a board, whether you're on an executive team, one woman is worthless. Two is better. Three is really the number you need to go for. Because at that mm-hmm. point, you have people who feel a sense of safety, like they belong. There's a difference between fitting in and belonging. Mm-hmm. And so for most of my career, I felt like I needed to fit in. And I'll also share that the tech company that I was a part of was a really connected, really, they were great guys. There were oftentimes we had executive offsites and people were crying and it wasn't me. Right. So these were great fathers, great husbands, but the majority of the wives weren't working. They were at home. And so I was very aware of the fact that I was there. My child was in school or daycare. So to me, it was a privilege to be a part of that. And the future that I'm up to creating now is how to change the workplace, how to change the expectations in the home, to create more, equality, to level the playing field, because it hasn't been level for a long, long, ever.
Ever.
Long time.
I was going to say, when was that?
Yeah.
Okay. We will return and have a group discussion between Kathy, Athena, and Lorraine when we return in just a moment in the Think Tank.
The Think Tank. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We are back. We're discussing women in the workforce. An interesting element of this is Kathy Sachs. You are involved with a project or an effort to actually fund women venture. You're functioning as venture capital.
That's right.
Which I wouldn't be surprised to hear that the women being on the funding side is massively underrepresented. Tell us about that effort, and have you been engaged in recruiting women who can write checks to involve themselves in this, and how has that gone?
Yeah, I think look, if we're waiting for men to write more checks to female founders, we're going to wait a long time. And so like anything, it's how do you take the matter into your own hands? And so what's really exciting mm-hmm. is we see a shift. 2018 to 2017, we saw a doubling from 21 billion to 46 billion in all of venture capital going to female-founded startups.
In 2 years, doubled?
No, in 1 year.
1 year.
Whoa. But also keep in mind, the proportion hasn't changed. It's gone from about 12% to 13% to 14% to now still at around 20% of all venture capital goes to female-led ventures. So the whole pool has increased.
Okay.
But the effort that I'm really excited about is a sign of the times, and it's called Golden Seeds, and it's a New York City-based angel network of about 80% women, 20% men, and the investment thesis is investing in women-led ventures. Studies show that women-led ventures show higher returns, greater profitability, and also a data point that I found recently is that there's an increased pace in moving to acquisition or IPO, which would mean liquidity for said investors. So we've got
there's an opportunity at the back end to sell and get your money out.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And what they're seeing is a trend among women-led ventures to move to that stage more quickly, which then would make it even more enticing to invest in women. Well,
an observation about that, if women are not getting a fair shake at the table from traditional investment sources, that must mean that there are some very good ventures that aren't getting funded, and these potentially can be not only good for the women who get the funds, but can be good for the investors as well.
You're very perceptive. Yeah. Indeed. Indeed. We're seeing a trend. Golden Seas is but one of many, many investing groups that is individually or as a group writing checks to women, to female founders, mostly in tech we're seeing. Mm-hmm. So there's healthcare, there's B2B tech, and then there's consumer. A lot of e-commerce business are seeing great success. And you see, but the point is we're seeing a greater number of women forming funds, forming groups, and investing in women.
You're doing this at the angel level, which for the person who's not in this business, that's early money.
Right. So it's early stage. Typically, it's in revenue, but it's still really early. And it's exciting. For me, I became an angel investor over a decade ago, and I didn't even know that that's what I was doing. I didn't even know that that's what it was called. And I was lucky enough, and I think bright enough, to recognize an opportunity. And
How'd that happen?
Well, I had a client that was a tech company called Infusionsoft. They still exist. They've actually changed the name to Keep. And I had a marketing agency at the time, and I got to meet this team, and they hired me as a client. They hired me, and they were a client. And this was before they had about 30 employees, pre-Series A, and I had an opportunity to invest.
Series A, that's early stage, right?
Series A would be a larger amount, typically in the multi-millions.
Post ego angel, and then Series
correct.
A.
Yeah, so friends and family, angel, money, and then Series A, Series B, C, D. Mm-hmm. That company has since gone on to have four rounds of funding, totaling well over $100 million. And it paid off. It paid off in a really nice high multiple. And you'd say I was really lucky for my first investment to actually have it pay off to the degree that it did.
Luck is usually the product of hard work and some smarts.
Yeah, for me, I got a taste. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that it taught me was running a business is a way to create value to where I'm not trading my time for money. I'm always looking at how to up-level that, right? And how to teach other women to do this as well. Mm-hmm. And while I was running my business, I was making a bet on other entrepreneurs. And the harder they work, the greater opportunity there is that there's a payoff. And also, I get to be part of something. And I get to watch it grow. And I get to mentor and advise and be along for the ride. So since then, I've invested in about five other companies. Interestingly enough, I'm typically the one or maybe one of two women on the cap table. The cap table is your list of all your investors. And so the Golden Seeds effort and this movement.
So even you're saying that the people who are investing the money are majority men still?
In the deals that I've been a part of.
Okay.
Here in Arizona.
Do you have a formal process? Are you a venture capitalist in the sense of having your
I'm casual about this, and the reason why
opportunistic.
Well, and so when I had the liquidity event with Infusionsoft early on, you look at Silicon Valley as an example. The reason why it is what it is because you had these companies that became these large. Imagine a tree, and it grew into this big tree that fruit came from that. And so the investors could benefit from that fruit. And you can either choose to reinvest those dollars and create seeds in your local area, or you take that money elsewhere. And so you can imagine, as that multiplies, why Silicon Valley has become what it has become, because you saw a constant bearing of fruit, then growth, harvest, grow, harvest, grow. So my thesis was to take some of that and put it into entrepreneurs. And it's been fun. And some of them have not done well.
Do they tend to be from around here?
Yeah, all of them. And all of them have been in tech.
Lorraine, your observation.
I'm saying, and we're back to tech. Tech is, every company almost is a tech company. I think Kathy brought up several good points. once you're at the table, it gives you an opportunity to learn new things and to bring other people with you. And I really, you know, that's a great story, Kathy, and it's true. I've known you since marketing and the Arizona Tech Council, and you've grown tremendously, and you've brought good people with you, and you've helped others a lot. I think it's fabulous.
Oh, thanks.
We had a couple minutes left. Athena, you've been sort of left here. I want to give you an opportunity to make some observations.
I think that it's really a great step in the right direction. I think there's both things that we're up against. You know, not only do we not, to your point, Lorraine, at the beginning, have laws that are strong enough to ensure that as more women are in the workforce and as they're increasing their responsibilities, that their pay levels are being protected. So we need stronger equal pay laws. And universities have done studies that show that when women enter fields in greater numbers, the pay declines versus when it was previously a male-dominated field. And so, you know, as we're moving forward, especially in places like tech, and we want to encourage more women to get into those industries and those fields, we need to make sure that these just inherent sexism and gaps we see are prevented from the get-go and not exacerbated by not addressing it.
Lorraine.
Okay, that's a really good point. In fact, what I've seen and lived is that in the 80s, we kind of peaked maybe around 90 or so, and actually the number of women and women at leadership levels, as well as some tech levels, is declining. And what happened? So many came in because it all sounded so good, and now we've got young girls all coming together. Well, we need to understand what that means and act.
Okay, you get the final word. Kathy Sachs, Athena Salmon, Lorraine Rogers, and Tammy Caputi is no longer here, but was here earlier on. Won't be the last time we take this up for sure. We'll see you next week in the Think Tank.
Come, the new Jerusalem. Silver cities rise, the morning lights, the streets that lead them, and sirens call them on.